Kunstraum, der Podcast vom Kunstraum Niederösterreich.
Hi and welcome to a new episode of our podcast series im Kunstraum. My name is Friederike Sperling and I'm the Artistic Director of Kunstraum Niederösterreich. On the occasion of the H13 Lower Austria Prize for Performance 2023, we had the pleasure to host an artist talk between this year's H13 winner Rehema Chachage and the artist Serena Lee. The talk took place within Rehema's exhibition A Home For You I Will Create with Exit Pathways, A Gut Feeling, which accompanied her eponymous performance piece. The show featured two architectural structures, photo prints, wallpaper sheets finished with a scent of soot from the kitchen of Rehema's grandmother in Tanzania, textural elements, as well as fabrics and a video. Before we're going to listen to the conversation, a brief introduction. Serena Lee works via polyphony to map how things come together and apart. She plays across cinematic, situated, and martial practices, tracing Tao through aesthesis. Serena practices and collaborates close to home and internationally. She holds an MFA from the Piet Zwart Institute in the Netherlands and an associate diploma in piano performance from the Royal Conservatory of Music. Born and raised in Toronto, Canada, Serena currently lives in Vienna, where she's a PhD in practice candidate at the Academy of Fine Arts. Rehema Chachage's artistic practice is characterized by a great diversity of media and methods. Visuality, sound, and smell combine in her performances and installations to create complex experiences. The source and setting of Rehema's practice is her family's matrilinear memory. Rehema studied at the Michaeli School of Fine Art, University of Cape Town, and at Goldsmiths, University of London. She is currently completing her PhD in practice at the Academy of Fine Arts in Vienna. And now, enjoy the talk.
Thank you so much, Federica. Thank you, everyone, for being here. And thank you, Rehema, for inviting me to have this conversation with you. And it's very exciting because this continues a sort of long conversation we've had, interweaving a lot of things with practice and research. And so I thought today it would be really great just to sort of unpack how the work that we are experiencing here, smelling, hearing, seeing, kind of feeling, how this also is just part of this broader ongoing thread of research that hasn't only just been within this time that you've been in Vienna, that mm-hmm. we've been in this PhD program together, but there's just a huge trace of voices. And I thought maybe we could start with actually hearing a bit more about the title and the voices that are in the room, in the text, but also where we might not necessarily see it so obviously, whose voices are here with us.
Mm-hmm. hello. there's many, many voices in the work. The ones that we can hear, and maybe many we can't hear, but the ones that we can immediately hear are my mother and grandmother often, because my practice does extend in that way within the lineage, within the matrilineage to my mom and grandmother through research and doing the voices we can't hear, I guess, is extending to the rest of the matriline, which I'm still discovering myself, some of which I've already discovered through processes of working, through researching. And the title itself is borrowed actually from like a very collective moment within Swahili storytelling. Mm-hmm. So it's like the curtain raiser, let's say the curtain raiser for Swahili storytelling. When you invite a story or you give a story, you have to sort of invite it or offer it, and it has to be received by the people who are present to receive it. Mm-hmm. And so it's a quote that comes from that, from the curtain raiser. I have an excerpt of it mm-hmm. somewhere in the texts over there on that corner. Mm-hmm. But yeah, mm-hmm.
So the texts are sort of interspersed around the room. There's some in these tiny little displays against the wall, but then also imprinted on the paper. And it strikes me, like, across the exhibition, there's so many different moments of impression and imprint and making marks in different ways, leaving marks that are perhaps more ephemeral, some are more solid. I wonder if you could talk about, I mean, I have so many questions around just that, but what were some of your decisions in deciding these different tonalities of imprint and when to have text and when to not have text?
I guess working through traces or imprints or leftovers, piecing together is like quite an integral process in my own research practice because of the many sort of histories that where I come from has been witnessed to. Tanzania is where I come from. There's a way that you can't always access every piece of history or story that would sort of complete your research. So there's a lot of work that has to go, that has to be done via piecing together, whether what is left behind through oral memories, through song, through what the land remembers, like naming of streets or, boulders that are in the middle of a street, or, as we talked about, invasive species that were planted so long ago, but they're not natively from your land, but also what your own body remembers through epigenetic memory, and kind of sort of working with it or through it to make some kind of sense there. And then there's also this idea of mark making that I worked with specifically with the suit, that is connected to my desire to write with my grandmother. I've always found it really easy to write with my mother, work with and write with my mother, but not as easy with my grandmother. And not because she can't read or write, she can, but I think she can read and write in a language that we might want to sort of preserve or keep at home, and also in a language that maybe can be sort of misunderstood as like super rudimental within certain spaces that are not the home space. But I go back to the etymological meaning of the process of writing, and it again says as long as you've made a mark, it's like it's a process of mark making. So as far as you've made a mark, you've written. And there's a lot of mark making that has that is apparent in my grandmother's kitchen, for example, from our own process of cooking with fire, and the soot that is produced from her fire, and the moments that have been shared around the fire that that lights her kitchen through while she's either handing down recipes, she's naming, she's exchanging with friends, and etc. And I just thought it would be really interesting to also consider this as a form of writing or a form of mark making that has its own intelligence and also kind of preserves, right? It doesn't give away everything as if it would if it was an essay that one is reading. And so, like with the suit, this particular mark making, it's all soot I've been collecting from my grandmother's kitchen. As a way of
all of these papers that have been hanging.
Yeah, I mean, some of it. So there's different processes. There's some that I leave on the roof of our kitchen for. Well, not just these. I have many more that are not published in this space right now. But some of them I leave on her roof for like a year, and I revisit them in a year. Some of them I hang directly above the fire in which we gather whenever I'm at home and we're exchanging. And talking, and like whenever there's a fire around, then I would hang, you know, these papers nearby, and they would absorb this soot over an extended amount of time. And then, you know, how they would come into space, how they would be published, what they would speak, how they would smell, is always kind of changing with time. So. Again, if you look at it in like in a writing sense, then there's always like a form of revision and reworking, etc. And then the paper that I have, for example, made imprints of the text on.
So the blue carbon papers.
Not the carbon paper. The smaller papers are also recycled paper that I've been recycling a lot of some of the older experiments I did with with this process. Mm-hmm. So recycling it back into new material and seeing how that material can also play a part in maybe not translating, but I'm lacking a better word. But like, yeah, another form, like a more textual form of communicating or writing. So, so that's what I've. So this is the first time I've used these papers to sort of imprint my thought process or my thinking around this particular exhibition, this idea of homemaking and history making. Through coming together and building together.
But the writing is also a form of witnessing. Like when you talk about the use of paper in the sense of like this paper has become something than what we're typically using paper for.
Yeah.
And that it's actually used for its absorbent material qualities of paper rather than a message that's printed on in a very textual sense.
Yeah.
So there's something about the way the materials that you use are bearing witness. And so, and something about the writing bearing witness. And I'm curious to hear, maybe also in referring to the what's happening with the weaving in the smaller room in the back there, storytelling seems to take so many different forms.
Yeah.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, also in terms of how like these different practices, the repetitive practices, the weaving, the architecture, maybe a little bit more about how exactly does storytelling happen? Because beyond the sort of the use of words, or what are the ways in which you understand wisdom or knowledge being transmitted?
Yeah, I mean, where I come from, the transmission of wisdom or knowledge is very embodied. Mm-hmm. I think often you can either miss everything or ask more questions if you noticed what just happened. Because I think there's never really a moment where somebody would come to you and say, okay, let me teach you this thing. It's all very experiential, either through certain rites of passages and things that would happen around you during those moments, and if you're curious enough to kind of sort of dig deeper into what it all means, it's always very, very embodied. So like I've not even though we do have a very rich storytelling tradition, poetry, stories, and everything, and gathering around and hearing stories. But storytelling doesn't always translate as like a super, as you say, like a literal verbal form of doing, because I've always experienced it in its like deepest form. I've always experienced it as like super embodied practice for me. And I think that in a way, I wanted that sense of like, sort of activating different senses in what you see, in what you smell. Like there's some ways I wanted to also work with the body, not just in my presence in the space, but also the body of the viewer that is in the space, in how they sort of engage with the different traces left behind.
Because you've also spoken about how the past and present are very interwoven in these ways, and in a way that embodied knowledge and embodied the transmission of knowledge through embodied practices, it can happen in a non-linear way.
Yeah.
And in the sense of like this activity of building a structure, or in these activities of weaving, there's something experiential about doing that with others where it isn't this sort of like linear transmission. Can you speak a little bit more about the like how that frames this sort of intergenerational learning?
Sorry, you have to say that again. Sorry.
I mean, there was a point when I was watching the works in the back room where I was reminded of we do these dumplings that are wrapped in bamboo leaves with string for a festival broadly in Chinese culture. And there was a point last year when I had to reteach my grandmother how to bind the string because she'd forgotten how to do it. And it was just a very strange moment because she was always the one who would teach me how to do it. And I think there's something about not like that wasn't a story that was told, right? There's a story attached to the dumplings, but there's something about in those moments where it's like, oh, this is really a weaving of what we've been learning together, no?
Mm-mm. Yeah, okay. I see what you mean. Okay, so the question was?
So how do these practices of, like, let's say, like, working the structures, because you've said that it's something that brings a community together.
I still don't know if I understood the story, but I do agree that it's, I think in a lot of ways it's very nonlinear, and I think this is like, it's not a very recent discovery, but it's a fairly recent discovery, because I've always thought of my practice and my way of working as that of receiving, like receiving what is being handed down, and I had never seen it as sort of a practice that can also offer or put something on the table. And I think since maybe last year, I think there's a shift that has happened where I can also put something on the table, even if it's still in the on the process of learning. Mm-hmm. But then I would be like, okay, I remember we talked about this at this time. Mm-hmm. Can we work with it or through it so that I can understand it better? Like even through that or through, I think I told you once when I found my grandmother, she was almost not working and I had a knee injury previously and I learned all these like massage techniques that I went and sort of repeated on her body, and she slowly started to regain her mobility. And this was like also a moment of learning, because she was like, okay, can you teach me how to do this? Can you teach this person who's taking care of me so we can keep doing this and I can get better and better? Yeah. So I think there's a non-linear way that I think these kind of exchanges or these knowledge forms can sort of take space, even though maybe with the one I just gave an example for, maybe I don't have like a super historical story to back it up. But maybe the history is in the making as I start to teach it to my grandmother or my mother in the future. Mm-hmm. And if it's something that lives within the family, maybe that's how anyway history is made. Mm-hmm. And with this particular project, you know, it had an earlier manifestation in Tanzania where I created like a curatorial project around it, mm-hmm. where I worked with artists, and then I worked also with my grandmother and my mother as like interlocutors. Mm-hmm. And so I never, like, again, that was like, because it was such a space of exchange, at the end of it, like, my grandmother herself was like, okay, this felt like a learning moment. She did not feel like she was entering that space as a teacher that's there just to teach. She was only there to share and then to understand what the younger generation is thinking, mm-hmm. and how they're engaging with these like sort of historical ways of doing. Mm-hmm. And also to learn from other interlocutors that are like a few generations younger than her. Mm-hmm. A few years older than her, and etc. So, yeah, I do agree that there's a way that it can be nonlinear.
Yeah, yeah.
If
you're receptive.
If you're receptive, thank you.
Yeah. Well, and yes. I mean, I think that also I was interested in what you've said in terms of exit pathways, because there's something also, and I was curious if you wanted to share a little bit about what it means to have this passage of going back home and then basically coming back here, to sort of like understand the research process and the artistic practice also through a lens of distance, and what it means to understand home in a different way when you can sort of step away, and then how that might affect what you understand as tradition, I suppose, because that's such a heavy term, no? And it's also so loaded in terms of, like, how we think of materials, but also just, like, what is considered knowledge in a traditional sense or, like, a modern sense? Who decides these things? Mm. So maybe, I'm curious what you think of in terms of, this aspect of distance and homemaking, and what this means for tradition and what you've called exit pathways.
Mm. Yeah, that's a tough question. Yeah, I think it's very interesting to take distance from home. There's always like a feeling of, you feel so complete, but also very slowly feel very frustrated whenever you go home. And then obviously when you leave, also there's this feeling of feeling really relieved and then immediately missing it so much. So I think the distance part always comes with this, want it or not, this sense of incompletedness or whatever. And for me, I think sort of circling back to the research that I do, mm-hmm. And the conversations that I have with my grandmother, with my mother, like I always think of, like, I don't know, I want to carry them as like the kind of foundations that sit in the space from where I will create a new home, whatever mm-hmm. form it will take here. Like, I don't imagine creating it out of a vacuum without like any sort of, yeah, foundation, anything holding it mm-hmm. up. And so this need or this want to always go back, to always research, to always expand the practice, to always have more conversations with my grandmother and etc., and then to come back here and look at it from a distance and find meaning around it from a distance, and to sort of set it as a foundation, I think this has become a really needed mm-hmm. practice for me. In terms of tradition, I think that's also another difficult thing to answer, because I think maybe tradition in my practice, I have to use it like super loosely, because I think many of the things I work with are not traditionally Tanzanian or traditionally Chasu per se, but they are tradition, or they have we have come to see them or know them as tradition mm-hmm. within the home space or the space that I grew up with. So I guess it's still mm-hmm. tradition, but I think it's also a little bit loose, because there's ways that people are rebelling against tradition, and from the kind of background I come from, it's allowed, because it's like it's a very open it's an open space. At least from my home, it's allowed to rebel against tradition. If mm-hmm. you want to, it's allowed to embrace tradition mm-hmm. if you want to. So it's your prerogative in a way. And I'm really losing track with this question. I'm really losing
track. The direction
you're talking about. Yeah. But I guess holding on to this tradition for me, or to these traditional ways, or embracing these traditional ways, is a choice for me in a way. It's not an expected thing. Yeah. It's not a thing where you'd be found too out of the mold if you go home and say, I'm rejecting all these things, I don't care about them, I don't think they are. But I think for me, it's become quite important with this distance that you talk about, to sort of hold on a little bit to these sort of traditional things, sort of make sense to them. I have a daughter too. Like, I always mm-hmm. I imagine maybe it's also a way of like keeping it within the practice as a form of archive, that this foundation that is holding us here, she will eventually maybe revisit and mm-hmm. choose what is important and leave out what is not. So as a form of like weaving through that lineage and not like mm-hmm. severing yourself completely from it, just because you've taken this distance.
But yeah, and also how reliant on the materiality, like those specific materials it is to be able to access these knowledge practices, and whether or not, like how much distance can you take before you lose the directness of those material, like what those materials bring.
Yeah.
Those practices.
And sometimes the materials themselves rebel against this distance. Like I've tried to ship things from Tanzania, and they would come completely destroyed.
Yeah.
They would refuse this voyage completely. Many, many times this has happened. Sometimes I've had to sort of bring the work almost into this fantasy space, or not fantasy, but like imaginary space, because I can't always use every material that I would use back home, either because, you know, taking it out of the country is so bureaucratic and impossible.
Yeah.
Either because the spaces, some of the spaces that you're exhibiting, maybe they don't accept certain materials mm-hmm. for whatever reason, pests, whatever. maybe like for many, many reasons. So, yeah. So also, it only works to an extent. I think many times also there's a rebellion that sort of yeah comes to life. At the end of, I think the materials also have a life of their own. So
for sure,
yeah.
As they should.
As they should. The papers I've burned so many. I've lost count at how many perished in this process. We'll just be sitting there talking, and it will be lunchtime. You go to eat, and you come back. There's no paper. So this has happened.
This paper's tendency to burn.
Yeah.
I wondered if you wanted to read anything for us, or we could keep on with questions, and I think we could also open it up for questions as well.
Yeah, I can read three texts, two of which are part of the space, and one of which is not part of the space, mm-hmm. I guess. Just like, just as a sort of mind map, or the early mind maps or thought processes that came before the idea of this exhibition. So I don't know if there's a particular order, but I'll just read. So the first one is more of prepositions. What does it mean to create with inherited knowledge as your guide? How can we explore soil as a medium for remembering? Pathways, solid yet fluid and porous, a space to both hold and release unsayable sounds, gestures, and memories, a space for navigation, a portal for bodies seeking to connect with and to the processes of homemaking and history making. And then I'm reading the second one. I conjured a thought once, a thought which my mind manifested while struggling to understand why my matrilineal ancestors chose the walls of their homes as sites for preservation of a child's umbilical cord, bracket. This Pan-African practice of bearing and preserving the umbilical cord is meant, in some cultures, to connect the child with their land, their home, and their future therein. To make sense of this, I thought to myself that perhaps the home is not necessarily where the heart is, that the home is perhaps more of a gut feeling, that nagging feeling in the gut which one cannot ignore, an instinct, an intuition, something which one feels without logic or rationale, something that has structure but also exit pathways. Then I read the third one. In my grandmother's narration, Chasu villages emerged as embodiment of interconnectedness, tradition, and communal wisdom. My grandmother's storytelling transcends time, transporting us, her listeners, to a historical era when the practice of clanship served as the very foundation of village formation. In this historical context, clans evolved beyond familial units, metamorphosizing into fundamental components that molded entire communities. At the center of each clan resided a central figure whose dwelling served as the genesis of a thriving community, with descendants constructing their homes around it. These homes collectively formed a perimeter from which wisdom flowed seamlessly, forging an intricate web that connected the past to the present. Every constructed house shared story and upheld tradition contributed to this collectivity. Through the art of storytelling, my grandmother's voice instills a profound reverence for interplay between knowledge centers and communal spaces, a domain from which legacies of intergenerational wisdom were meticulously passed down. Beyond all oral traditions and practices, the preservation of cultural heritage took tangible forms. The barrier of umbilical cords within home spaces symbolized an unbreakable bond between individuals and their land, fostering a continuum that traversed time. The very soil beneath foundations echoed the tales of bygone generations, ancestral wisdom, enduring traditions, and echoes of past struggles ingrained in the earth. The soil bore witness to their journey, a testament to their resilience against the currents of history. My grandmother's voice underscores that these practices of building and maintaining were not mere survival mechanisms. They represented potent acts of defiance against forces of erasure. And the last one, building here, becomes both a metaphor and a measure. It is not limited to material form. What is created is intangible but also social. Soil is connected to soil and people to people. A structure is constructed, but eventually it must be reconstructed. Structures made of soil lack longevity, especially when a community is absent to look after and maintain them. This is therefore an opportunity for continuous connection in commitment to ongoing creation and care without an endpoint. It is a foundation, a base, and a premise.
It's a nice note of possibility to end on.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Rahava.
Thank you. Thank you so much.